Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Hey, Viet, how are you?
Good, Ken. How are you?
Good. It's been a whirlwind, I'm sure, in your world recently. Thank you so much for spending the time now. I hope things have died down a bit.
No, they haven't, which I guess is a good thing. Things are still pretty busy.
What are you busy with?
There's been the TV premiere, obviously, but I also have a new children's book that just came out, Simone. Which I'm very proud of. And of course, the rest of my life continues with just writing and literature and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. How do you have time? You know, you follow your social media, you follow your comments, you respond to it. You've recently had some really cool rebuttals to some of things. We don't need to go into that because the audience can go find that. Do you follow what the Vietnamese press and the diaspora Vietnamese press writes about you?
I'm curious, admittedly. I have research assistants who find things for me, send me the articles and interviews and all that kind of stuff. And I am kind of curious about how the Vietnamese people, including the media, are responding to the sympathizer. So I don't respond to these things directly, but I'm curious to know what the reactions are, positive and negative, just for my own sake.
And what do you think of it all so far?
I think it's a healthy discussion. It's unfolded pretty much exactly as I imagined it would. The sympathizer, the novel, and the TV series are provocative works, especially for people who are seeking validation through representation. And if that's what people want, they're not going to get it. The novel and I think the TV series are designed to certainly represent, but to provoke through representation, not validate. And that's a very key distinction. And then, of course, expectations are very, very high on all sides, many sides, whether people are in Vietnam or overseas, whether they were for or against the war or the communists, or et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, there's going to be some strong opinions. And I think that's a good thing. Good TV series, good entertainments should expect to have strong opinions if the art is strong.
I don't know how many times I get asked a week what I think about it. And I always, it's weird. And I'm like, I think about what would Viet say if he was me? And I approach it by answering that there are many viewpoints in country, in Vietnam, and there's many viewpoints in the diaspora. And then there's many levels to the different viewpoints, whether they're generational, there's gender breakdowns, there's all sorts of things. And it really surprises me to hear the responses of certain people in the community. And it's never like the ones where you think, oh, this is not like, it's not about the acting or it's not about the accents or it's things that, it goes back to that whole idea of like authenticity that you talk about. There is no one way that these responses are coming out from friends of mine or acquaintances. When you look at somebody, you think that they're going to have this sort of viewpoint, but I have really, it's really opened up my eyes to see that some of the most staunch, quote unquote, Vietnamese authentic people love this series and they love the being provoked to think differently. And then there's some people that are like really far out there, really creative, that really, didn't gel with it. It's just really crazy to see how people react to it.
I think that's a healthy thing. Just because we're Vietnamese and we're in the arts, for example, doesn't mean we have to love everything that involves Vietnamese people and the arts. That kind of dispute is maybe partly about questions of authenticity or content or so on, but it may also just simply be a people's reaction to the particular style of a work of art. In this case, the sympathizer, the novel, and the TV show are both very highly stylized. They come from very, I think, strong aesthetic and political viewpoints, both on my part, but also Park Chan-wook. He's not the only creative person involved with the TV show, but he's certainly been the most strongly identified with it in terms of whose vision behind the camera is steering everything. And so, if there are people who don't like the sympathizer for the style, not just because of the content, I can imagine there are people who don't like the style of the TV show as well, or who have conflicted feelings about it. Because I think Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr. and Sandra Oh and all the Vietnamese actors, they're coming in there with their complete, total artistic souls. So, and when you do that, you just can't expect to please everybody, whether it's Vietnamese people or whether it's Americans or whether it's the rest of the world. So I think those of us who are involved with the show, hopefully we can just leave all that behind. If there are Vietnamese people, Vietnamese Americans or Vietnamese people who object to the show for various things, I take heart from the fact that there are so many non-Vietnamese people who really seem to enjoy the show. And that's the ratio that we should have.
Now, as a creator of a book, and you are seeing the book play out in on screen, are you pleased with it?
I'm pretty pleased with it. I'm way too close to the production to say whether it's great or not. And it's simply going to be up to the circumstances, whether the show becomes a hit or viral or wins awards or whatever. So I don't worry about any of that stuff. My stance always from the beginning was that there were certain red lines that I was not willing to cross, and we have not crossed any of those. And that what was really important, since this was going to be a collaborative enterprise and I was not going to do most of it, that the collaborators had to be people that I really respected and admired. And that was what happened. We were really lucky and good at picking the right collaborators. And so, at the very least, what we've produced is a series that is at least good, and a series that we can all be proud of, and certainly I'm proud of.
You said red lines. Could you share those with us?
I think that a very significant red line would be it had to have primarily Vietnamese actors. They could be from Vietnam, they could be from overseas, but it had to be of Vietnamese origins or ancestry, playing Vietnamese people. And that we had to have as much Vietnamese language in the show as possible. It certainly would not be permissible for me if people were speaking English when they clearly should be speaking Vietnamese, or when they would have to speak English with a Vietnamese accent. That was just not. I would have taken my name off if those two things had happened. I mean, how faithful the TV series would have been as an adaptation of the book, that was a little bit fuzzier of a line, because obviously, as an adaptation, things would have to be changed. So there was really, I don't know what exactly would have provoked me, but that was a careful balancing act between my acknowledgement that there would have to be change and my sense that there would be certain changes that would have been, I simply would not have agreed with. So, for example, I think back to Graham Greene's novel, The Quiet American, which is a novel that I've wrestled with and the sympathizer responds to, but the movie adaptation of The Quiet American in the 1950s actually completely reversed the ending of the book, because The Quiet American by Graham Greene, who's English, was very critical of Americans. And then the end of the movie adaptation actually turned that around to make it more sympathetic to Americans. So if something equivalent had happened to the sympathizer in the adaptation process, I would have walked away.
You write about often you talk about Vietnamese people depicted in film as, being told by a different group of people, white people, doing our narrative. And it's frankly, it's just not accurate. But when I think about the creators, of the producers and the creative team, for the most part, a lot of them were not Vietnamese, but the actors and the red line that you talk about, you got that. But the sort of the creative team, I think, when you're reading the credits, they weren't entirely Vietnamese. Do you feel like we were portrayed in a way that satisfied you?
I think so. And again, we get to this collaborative issue. I remember this one guy, I'm not going to name this person, just a random person, said over social media, like, how dare you not have a Vietnamese director or producer on this? And I was like, We have talented Vietnamese directors, obviously, but do we have somebody that HBO would entrust with $100 million? What do you think, Ken?
No,
No, I don't think so.
not yet, not
Okay.
yet. But I have something that interesting to add to this after you're done.
But it's a very complicated situation because in order for us to have had a show where you would have 100% authenticity behind the camera, you would have to have literally dozens, hundreds of people who are of Vietnamese descent who would be have the experience to handle some of these issues and then would also be willing to work on the show. And so I don't think people have acknowledged enough the difficulties that we have faced trying to work with people of Vietnamese nationality or citizenship. It's not that we don't want to work with people. It's that I think that there were some people who removed themselves from consideration because they were afraid of the political complications of working on this show. So that was a sort of an invisible constraint that was placed upon the show that I think a lot of people may not be aware of. And the other thing is that for certain aspects of the show, which are being shot in the United States, for example, we had to work with American-based talent. So wardrobe, for example, we do have Vietnamese people working in wardrobe, but the head of wardrobe costumes, whatever it's called, Danny Clicker, he's great. And his job was partly to, reproduce everything that looked like the United States in the late 1970s. I'm not sure we could have found someone from Vietnam who could have done that kind of work. Or someone with a Vietnamese American who had seniority that A24 or HBO would have agreed to. So there were all these constraints that were taking place. The producers, Nhi Phichmin, I mean the first producer, Nhi Phichmin, the guy who approached me and optioned this originally, he's Canadian, not Vietnamese. But there wasn't no Vietnamese person approached me to option the show. And would there have been a Vietnamese producer with the clout and the
Right.
experience to pull this off? I don't know. Don McKellar, co-showrunner, Canadian. He had worked with Park Chan-wook before. I mean, partly for me to work with Don and Neve was a recognition that at least they weren't Americans. I think Americans would have screwed me over in a lot of ways in some of the key creative components of this. Park Chan-wook, not Vietnamese, however, a genius. And someone whose aesthetic and political vision really vibes with me. The more I talk to him, the more I hear what he says in interviews, the more I hear how he describes the show in public, the more I think he's actually much more in sync with me than a lot of Vietnamese people. And so given that choice, in some sort of hypothetical scenario, should I work with any Vietnamese person or should I work with a non-Vietnamese person whose aesthetics and politics very closely match with mine? I would always choose the latter.
In the early days when Park Chan-wook was announced, I had had conversation with some of the director friends of mine that I consider sort of the best in the business. And they were like, we should be thankful that a director at that caliber has chosen this story to tell. And they were all, they all stood behind it. But I mean, and I think they understand the value from the inside. They really get it. And that was really telling. And at that point, I was like, okay, this makes perfect sense.
Yes, it's a gigantic corporate behemoth working with HBO or the equivalent, right? And you have to be realistic to a certain extent, and I'm sure these directors are. Of course, we want to reach a moment where we have Vietnamese talent that's capable of doing all the behind the scenes stuff as well at the very highest levels. And that I don't know how long that will take. And you and with your production company and all the people that you know have a better sense of it than I do. But my reading of it is that there's a certain level of constraint, at least working with people in Vietnam because of their particular political boundaries that have been set on the film and television industry in Vietnam. So as long as we're making things that have some kind of political controversy related to Vietnamese content, I mean, we're going to still run up against some of these limitations.
Yeah, that's a truth. The speaking of high level, the premiere was fantastic. It was just such a beautiful evening. And you showed up on the red carpet with an Ao Dài. And I've read posts from your wife Lan saying that, I've never been able to get him to wear one. Even during our wedding, I couldn't get him to wear one. 20 years later, he wears one. How did it make you feel?
Well, it made me feel like $1 million, or at least $300, which is what it cost. I resisted wearing the aoyai because the aoyai that I grew up with, in terms of men's aoyai, were just very traditional. Didn't spark an interest in me. I was not interested in, again, demonstrating my Vietnamese authenticity in that way. I'm much more interested in sort of more complicated notions of authenticity and inauthenticity and hybridity. And so the aoyai that Lan chose was designed by Tang Nguyen Atelier. And he's on the cutting edge, I think, of aoyai design, as far as I know. Did a fantastic job with Lan's custom-made aoyai. And for me, I got one of the off-the-rack things that fit me perfectly. And I think it's very interesting to get an aoyai from Tai, because he is a part of this more hybridized diasporic relationship to fashion, authenticity, culture. So working out of the same galaxy of assumptions that someone like me is coming from. And I think that the premiere demonstrated that. There were a lot of people wearing the more traditional aoyai. There were a lot of people wearing Tai's creations, or at least more modern versions of aoyai. There were people wearing, a Western fashion, let's say, designer brands. Zui Nguyen showed up in, he plays Mutton. He showed up in Burberry, I think, according to his Instagram post, but he was barely covered, which is
It
great.
was
It was fabulous. And then behind the scenes, we had a Vietnamese American DJ, and then we had Bé U, doing the most of the catering and brodards. And so it was all of it was like diasporic, hybridized kinds of takes on Vietnamese culture, which was perfect.
yeah, it was lovely. Lovely to see all the Demon Slayer and Bernard and Bo. Will you wear it again out? I mean, is this a consideration for you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I like the way it looked. People like the way it looked. It fit well and all that. There were some other men wearing other Tai Nguyen Atelier creations, and I was like, "Yeah, I want one of those," but that might cost me more. So we'll see.
I saw and have been following, you brought your sister to the premiere. Can you tell me how that all like went down? Because she's coming from Vietnam, right?
Well, I mean, that story is something that I think resonates with a lot of Vietnamese people, because the war fractured families for a lot of us. In my family's case, we had left her behind in 1975, amidst all the chaos, terror, and confusion of the end of the war, and she was 16 years old. So she had been left behind to fend not fend for herself, but to guard the family property, which she could not do. She was 16. And so all that was taken from her, and she was sent to work on a youth brigade to rebuild the country, specifically around Đắk Lắk, where our hometown was in Buôn Ma Thuột, now Buôn Ma Thuột. And so I would not see her again until 2004, when I would go back to Vietnam, I think, for the second time. And then from 2004 till now, I didn't see her again in person either, although we're Facebook friends. So that means once in 49 years, I got to see her. And she just emailed me a few weeks ago and said, "Oh, I'm coming." I got my visa. I'm coming. I was like, "Okay, well, you didn't ask me, or you didn't tell me what dates or anything, but fine. I'm not going to. This is great. So we'll make it work." And her timing couldn't have been better. I mean, we didn't plan it. She just happened to show up exactly at the moment when the premiere
Oh,
was
she
going
didn't know?
on.
Like, you didn't
She didn't
invite
know
her?
it. I mean, she knew there was a TV show, but I don't think she knew that this was the premiere week. So she came a few days before that, and it was great to see her interact with my children and to teach them some Vietnamese. And I took them out of school for several days so we could go around and do touristy things with their aunt. And then I had been invited to go to the private party the day before the premiere, and I emailed everybody involved, and I said, "Look, I can't. My sister's coming from Vietnam," and immediately, the team responded, saying, "No, I mean the team Downey wants you to be there. Take your sister along." And
Wow.
so she and I was like, "Okay, well, ask her." I said, "Hey, you're not going to know anybody here. Do you want to go?" She said, "Yes, I want to go." So we were the first ones to show up at this very fancy private party at the Chateau Marmont, one of the legendary hotels on Sunset Boulevard. We were the first to show up. The next person to show up 10 minutes later was Robert Downey Jr. And he was gracious, I mean, but I have to say one thing here. When I told my sister about everybody that was coming, she was most excited about Gu Jin and about Gu Zuyin, not about Robert Downey Jr. But up, he was very gracious, took photos with her. He had his personal photographer doing photographs of all the cast and the producers and so on. And so we had our picture taken by his personal photographer. So she had a blast, I think. I mean, she was totally, I mean, she could barely speak English, but she was totally fitting in and taking selfies and all this kind of stuff. Everybody was treating her great. And the next day was the day of the premiere. And my brother comes, and he hadn't seen my sister in 49 years in
Wow.
person, you know? So it was the Hollywood ending, not ending, but whatever, the conclusion to this particular phase of our family story. I just feel very grateful that circumstance made that possible, even if at the same time, that happy exclamation point in the middle of our story as a family was only made possible ultimately by the tragedy of the
Yeah.
war.
I talk about this idea of the inability to fully communicate with each other when one part of the family speaks only Vietnamese, the other part is raised with English. And I'm imagining that your sister and you are two people who are probably not fully firing on words. Did she ever express like how she felt with, how far you've come?
So, we're on Facebook, and before her visit, we were communicating, and Google Translate is a good helper here. I mean, with Vietnamese, it's not great, but I have enough Vietnamese so I can correct the problems with Google Translate, but at least it give me a draft to write, you know. And then when she got here, we did not speak English. So I was really kind of worried. Like, I don't, what am I going to talk to her about for 7 days or 8 days,
Yeah.
however long she was with me? And in fact, we spoke every all at the time, only in Vietnamese, like 90% in Vietnamese. And the 10% that we didn't, Google Translate, I was like, oh God, I don't know this word. And it was great. So I knew more Vietnamese than I thought I did. She was very forthcoming with some of the very difficult experiences that she had had after the war, which, I found very moving in good and bad ways. And so far as, me, yeah, she was very proud, and she was like sending messages home to the Vietnamese relatives. And can you imagine, like, okay, your friend or relative goes to Hollywood, and the first thing they do is send home pictures of Jin, Guzui, and Robert Downey Jr., all this kind of like Hollywood stuff. I took her to Sunset Boulevard, and there's a building on Sunset Boulevard where there's a gigantic poster of the sympathizer that's all draped over the entire building. And so, we took a picture there, very Hollywood. And so she was so happy about that part of being able to be included in all of this and, partaking in my success. So yeah, she was very, I think wonderstruck, I guess, by this circumstance in her life and mine.
I mean, anybody would, right? It's pretty crazy when you think about you know of this family member across the ocean, and then all of a sudden you find yourself 49 years later in the midst of Hollywood. I mean, and really in the thick of it.
Yeah, one day I'll write about it. Well, actually, I did write about it. I've been giving these lectures at Harvard, and the last lecture I gave was last week, and it concludes with this anecdote that I just described of, my sister coming and meeting my brother for the first time in 49 years in my house, taking her to the Hollywood premiere and all that. But really, the last thing was that she really wanted to come to see my father. My mother had passed away. She wasn't able to get a visa for that. So she was able to get a visa to come and see my father. So after she left LA, she flew up to San Jose where my father is. And I told her, look, he may not remember you because he's on the downward slope of memory loss. He barely recognizes me. I don't think he even recognizes me, or he pretends to recognize me. But she texted me and she said he, in fact, when she came into his room, she asked him, do you recognize me? And he murmured an assent. And then the two words he said to her when she was with him initially were Vui Lam. And I was like,
Oh.
God. Again, I can't script that better, because I thought I was worried that he would not recognize her in any way. And in fact, it appears that he did.
That's a beautiful story. I want to ask you, when you think about all of the research that you've done to get to finish the sympathizer. And as you look back, what are some of the things that the communist government got right? And what are some of the things that the South government, the Republic got right?
You mean in terms of the politics and
Yeah, just
yeah.
overall, like, what did
You're
they
gonna
do?
cancel Ken? If I acknowledge a communist did anything right, like county community and the anti-communists would be like, how dare he even
But
acknowledge
I'm glad you
a
said that
communist,
because I think we oftentimes we overlook it. Look, I come from three generations of the South, which is my grandfather got killed, and I say this a lot of the time. My grandfather got killed by the Viet Minh. My uncles, my father, all of them served in the South military. I was a US Marine. So it's like it's time to kind of move on and let's just talk about what they did right. I don't know. I'm always curious about what they did right. And then what did the South government, I mean, we think that we did a lot of things right, but in your, because you're taking so many different views, I would like to hear what you think that the South government got right.
So my take on this is that it was a both a revolutionary war and a civil war. But even saying that gets me in trouble, because I think I said I think I said, I described it as a civil war in a social media post, and I think somebody from Vietnam said it wasn't a civil war. That would imply that the country was divided, and no, it's like we were all Vietnamese, and so even using certain terminology is problematic already. But I think it was both. I think it was a revolutionary war against outsiders in Vietnam, and I think it was a civil war between Vietnamese people of different political beliefs. When you have a revolutionary war and when you have a civil war, it's going to be terrible. People are going to do terrible things on all sides.
Yeah.
And that's not to absolve anybody or to argue that all these things are symmetrical. It's just simply, the every faction was involved in trying to eliminate other factions. Okay. So nobody was really that innocent in the long run. That's obviously what the sympathizer is about. We have the luxury, those of us who are younger, of not having been direct eyewitnesses to that. So I can imagine people of an older generation, if your family had been assassinated by the other side, would you be in a forgiving mood? Probably not. So I think I understand it, but I have the luxury of being freed
Right.
from that particular kind of emotional scarring and obligation and sense of obligation. So we get to benefit from the historical consequences of wars that we didn't have to fight, those of us of a younger generation,
Yeah.
us and younger than us. Think back to like the Revolutionary War of the United States. Like a third of the of Americans fought on the English side. Those what happened to them after the end of the war? I don't know. Who cares? Historically speaking, who cares, right? I'm sure they cared, and I'm sure everybody cared from until like the early 1800s, but we don't have to care. So I think that's going to be the outcome as well of this particular history of war and its aftermath for Vietnam. That in the end, I think the ultimate goal was correct. The goal was a unified and independent Vietnam that did not have foreign influence and control over the country. Now, who deserved to win? I don't know who deserved to win, but the communists won, and I have no problem with the fact that Vietnam is unified under communist rule. That is something that the Vietnamese people collectively decided through struggle and bloodshed. We just happen to be on the losing side. I think we, you and me, can.
Yep.
And I don't have a problem with that either. So the but it's simply a fact to deal with. That being said, I think what the South got right out of all of this, and what the North got right, or what the communists got right, was they got the right strategy. They did whatever they had to do to win, and whatever they internal, external factors, all this kind of stuff we don't have time to get in with, but they did it. They won. The South, what the South got right, I think, was a better sense of democracy. At this in the South, even under military rule and secret police and American influence and all these kinds of things, there was still greater space for freedom of expression. That didn't mean there wasn't political repression and torture and imprisonment. That stuff happened for sure. But there was still some greater space for disagreement and dissent. That doesn't exist, so far as I can tell, in communist Vietnam. I mean, there is some freedom to do what you want to do, but if you contradict some kind of red line that the government has, that's not permissible. So I wish there was some magical blend of living in a society in which, the people who won the war get to run the society, but that they still allow for dissent, democracy, freedom of speech, things like this. I don't know if we're ever going to get to that, but that would be sort of the ideal world for me.
Yeah, and I asked you that question as an exercise in my right to ask these questions because 3 years ago, I would never dare to ask a question like that. But because you've sort of led the way with really just saying and speaking your mind and kind of showing that there needs to be a plenitude of storytelling and we can't just be afraid always to be canceled. And with that, I want to ask you, are you ever in that space of worry to be, canceled?
Well, of course, I think anybody who's sensitive to political and cultural realities, but also to human sensitivities, should be worried about being canceled.
But even when you're saying the things that really make sense in the long arc of history, like you're really standing up for the suppressed and you're really standing up for the people who have no voice.
I think it's a, first of all, I think that one has to have the strength of one's convictions. Number one has to have convictions. Okay. So you have to, in my case, I think I'm constantly trying to think through what my convict, I know what my convictions are, but I'm trying to think through how the social political situations I face have to be reconciled with the convictions that I have. Now that's the hard part. Because if I'm being canceled for my convictions, I don't have a problem with that. And cancellation can mean many things, right? Up to being fired, boycotted, even worse kinds of things. But if I'm doing what I think is right, I'm okay with the consequences. Now, the challenge, however, is that the social and political landscape is always changing, and I'm always being confronted by things that I've not fully thought through. So that's the dangerous part, is like, how do I reconcile things I have not yet fully thought through with my convictions? I'm gonna have to do some work. I'm gonna have to learn. I'm gonna have to educate myself. I'm gonna have to expose myself to people who are better informed than I am, so that I can come to a conclusion that I can be comfortable with that is amenable to my convictions. So right now we're talking about something that, in terms of the Vietnam, the war, the consequences, I think I'm pretty good. I think I know this history. It doesn't mean that obviously everybody will agree with me. In fact, it's a guarantee that not everybody will agree with you, no matter what position you take on any of the issues we've discussed so far. And if I'm being canceled in the Vietnamese language press, or I'm being canceled in the anti-communist world, or if I'm being canceled in Vietnam, which I think has happened, I'm okay with that. I mean, it doesn't mean that it causes me pain in various ways, but I'm okay with that.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phac.
Yeah, and there's a new space, but we'll get into that towards the end, which is the Israel Gaza stuff that that's been going on, and it's now happening at our school USC. I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on all of that. As you're sort of like watching the series and you're going through production, and I'm assuming you visit set, what goes on through your mind as you're watching words come out of actors' mouths or signs or the actual landscape, physical landscape of the set design?
Everything was created inside my head, in a small room, and based on research, much of it. But then to see it being converted from words on the page into this gigantic enterprise that literally involved hundreds of people, including many very, very talented artists in their own right, was surreal, unreal. I like to say that, for writers, the only thing that our art costs us is our lives, and no one cares about the lives of writers. But a TV show, this kind of TV show, costs $100 million at the very least. When you have all that money being thrown at it, a lot of people are going to care before the thing is even finished. And so it was really interesting just to go there and just see the sheer scale of the spectacle involved in the making of it. When people watch the TV show, it's already a spectacle, but the making of it is also a spectacle, just to see just how much time and energy is being invested into this. So it was humbling, and it was exciting, and it was amusing all at the same time.
You got to see all of that kind of unfold in real time after you've written the novel and you've made the deal and everything like that. Prior to all of that, though, did you ever imagine or manifest any of this stuff coming into before the first page that was written?
Oh, never, never. I thought I was pretty sure this would be a novel that Hollywood would never want to make, exactly for the reasons that we know about, which is who wants to spend $100 million in Hollywood, in the United States, to allow, like dozens of Vietnamese people to talk. That's the reality of it, right? Like you could imagine $100 million for a bunch of white guys to do stuff, but like for a bunch of Vietnamese people, the cast is, I think, like 90% Vietnamese. I'm just taking a guesstimate from the looks of things and the dialogue. I don't know what the ratio or the quantity is, but there's a lot of Vietnamese dialogue going on in here. And the content is it's a weird kind of a content, I think, for Hollywood, for Americans, for maybe the world, in the sense that it's not so remote that we are distanced from it and therefore don't have to care about it, like Shogun. Like I haven't watched Shoguns. I'm not dissing Shogun or anything. I'm just saying like Shogun is like a really complicated historical, it's set in a really complicated historical time period of which Americans and most people all over the world know nothing.
Right.
And yet they're willing to watch it. The Vietnam War, again, most people don't know a lot about it, but it's a little bit too close, a little bit too potentially provocative. I think you can't really romance it in the way that you could exoticize the Shogun period, for example. So we're in a really challenging situation with the content of The Sympathizer. So no, when I was writing the novel, given and especially given the way that I knew I was going to write the novel as something that was provocative and unapologetic and no holds barred, I just really had no illusions that Hollywood would want to or dare to make it. So, joke's on me, I guess, in the end.
And do you think we're, can you tease perhaps any of the other books that you've written that might turn into another season?
Well, I mean, there's a sequel called The Committed. I think HBO should be well aware of it. I don't know. I've done my best to like just drop hints. Hey, there's another book, but who knows? It's even more of a challenge with The Committed because the sequel of the Sympathizer, The Committed, which continues with the adventures of the captain and Bon in Paris, it's a gangster drama, lots of violence, lots of spectacle and all that kind of thing. But it's in Paris, it's in France, and it's I think of it as the anti-Emily in Paris because it's set in the refugee quarters and the immigrant quarters of Paris where the people of color are. I mean, I think Hollywood might be willing to spend $100 million on Emily in Paris, but are they going to spend it on Vietnamese and Algerian refugees fighting it out over the drug turf in Paris of the early 1980s? We'll see.
It all depends on how well this does, right?
It's exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And can Robert Downey Jr. speak French? I don't know.
So, we in America, we've seen protests against the war in Vietnam in the 70s, and a lot of stuff took place. And there's a history of all of this, students against the government or students against the administration, and we're seeing it. I can't believe we're seeing it in modern times in ways that are like just blatant. And you happen to be sitting in the middle of all of this, and you're speaking up, you're speaking out against it. It's in particular a student. Was she the valedictorian and she's the graduation commencement speaker?
Yes, I mean, the way it works is that at USC, you have to apply to be valedictorian, but the GPA cutoff is 3.98. So it's really high. And I assume the reason why they don't just pick someone who is like the very top GPA is there's probably multiple people with the top GPA. And so you have to have some kind of selection process. So I think out of 100 or 200 applicants, a senior named Asna Tabassum was selected by the faculty committee to be the valedictorian. And she, I think, is a biomedical engineering student, if I remember right, but her minor was in resistance to genocide, which is an actual minor at the Center for Advanced Genocide Research or the Shoah Foundation, Shoah Center at USC. So it's a minor born out of the recognition that genocides have actually happened, obviously to Jewish people, but also to Armenians and to other populations as well. And she had liked on her Instagram, and as far as I can tell, it was one like of a pro-Palestinian page that had included language about the abolition of Israel. I don't believe she ever said anything herself before this. But once it was announced that she was valedictorian, a number of groups who were pro Israel lobbied against her. And the provost of USC decided to cancel her speech altogether, citing various security threats, which were never specified. So we really don't know what those security threats are or why USC wouldn't have been capable of protecting Asna Tabassum as well as all the campus, given that the previous year Barack Obama came to attend his daughter's graduation. So it's infuriating in a lot of different ways, certainly on the part of just administrative decisions and so on, but most infuriating because USC, like pretty much every other university, has very high-flown, ambitious rhetoric about academic freedom, academic principles, teaching our students to engage with the world, to be critical, to be provocative, to be curious, all these kinds of things. And here's a real world scenario where all of these principles are being put to the test. And it just seems like USC failed in every respect. Certainly canceling is a failure, but even if you were to say we don't think it's safe to have her give a speech or she's potentially a very controversial speaker, there were so many other ways that USC could have addressed this, from having her record the speech to have it given visually, to having her to having a moment of silence to acknowledge that there was a valedictorian that won't be allowed to speak. So many different possibilities that were never addressed by our administration.
But why do you think that there's the lack of creativity to approach this?
You got me, Ken. Look, I mean,
Mean, it
you're talking to
sounds
a
so
university
simple.
professor. Like professors have a very difficult relationship with administration, right? Because the people who make it to administration, they're academics as well, but they're also people who have known, who have developed skills about how to negotiate bureaucracy and dealing with boards of trustees and recognizing the fact that a university like USC is a multi-billion-dollar corporation. So it's not only principles of academic freedom and the intellectual mission that matter, it's money, power, influence, politics, all these kinds of things. And so people who are able to negotiate that kind of a system may not be the ones that are most capable of standing immediately on controversial principles, or principles that should not be controversial but become controversial when they're faced with certain worldly situations, which is what's happening here at USC, but also obviously at a place like Columbia, which is seeing widespread student protests and the Columbia president having NYPD arrest 100 students, and Barnard College as well, and students being suspended and evicted from their dormitories, things like this. These are, I think, measures designed to placate political powers and economic powers on the Board of Trustees and in Congress that are probably threatening the careers of the presidents and administrators in question, which brings up a real important issue, which is what is the ultimate test for a university administrator? Is it to appease the powerful, or is it to protect the students?
Yeah, if I was the provost, I'd call all my homies, all the Viet Thanh Wins of the campus up, right? I'd sit down and say, "Can we get creative here? Can we figure out a response that would please everybody?" And so it makes me question, is it a lack of creativity? Is it a lack of intention? Is it just that they just have to roll over and take it from higher powers that this is a business and we're going to take a hardline approach here?
This issue about Israel's war in Gaza has obviously been happening since at least October 7th, but has obviously been an issue for much longer than that. I think the problem is probably that the university administrations do not want to deal with a controversy unless they're forced to deal with a controversy. So I don't think they've had very good strategies. I think they're in reactive mode. And so, what probably should have happened from a much earlier period is that university administrations should have thought creatively about how do we even talk about this issue after October 7th, if that's the triggering incident. How do we talk about this issue? How do we manage these relationships? How do we deal with an issue that is as divisive for this time and this generation as the Vietnam War was divisive for the world in the 1960s and the 1970s? That it's exactly the terrain that the sympathizer gets into, right? Where people of utter conviction and sincerity find themselves on completely opposite sides. So universities could have become much more creative about trying to even deal with this before crises happened, and they weren't. And so when a very predictable crisis like this happened, whether it's canceling the valedictorian at USC or whether it's with students being completely fed up and deciding to take over public space, common space at Columbia, this should all have been anticipated by university administrations. I think at least by January, February, they should have been thinking about this. And because they apparently weren't, or weren't thinking about it creatively enough, and were not, in fact, consulting with the faculty, which at least is true at USC, the faculty are upset that they were never consulted on any of these things, then things will blow up in your face.
When I'm out and I'm having a good time, like on a red carpet or some public event, I'm thinking about in the back of my mind the stuff that's happening in Israel and Gaza. I can't imagine what goes through your mind when you're at the premiere of your life's work and you're having a great time. You're the center of it all. But in the back of your mind, or not even the back of your mind, you're still posting this stuff like on Instagram and social media. How do you deal with the two worlds of like there's death and destruction, but yet there's glamour and there's beauty in the work that you've produced in the world?
I think about how, in fact, my work, even though it deals with the Vietnam War, at least a sympathizer does, is completely connected to the present. That's always been my conviction, that I was never writing only about the past. I was writing about the present, because all of the various energies and contradictions that motivated the war in Vietnam and led to such terrible outcomes are still the same contradictions and energies that we have now. And during the Vietnam War, where while all these terrible things were happening in Vietnam, and there were anti-war movements erupting all over the world and everything, it was still the case that for most people, life just continued. They did what they were going to do, and that was true for Hollywood as well. So you could be watching the war on television during the 6 p.m. news, and then go out and have dinner and a martini, or go to your movie premiere in the 1960s. Same things were happening. So the same challenges exist for us. For me, because my life is not in Hollywood. I'm a writer and a professor, and I've overlapped with Hollywood now, but that's not my career. So maybe I have more luxury than other people whose lives are entirely based in Hollywood itself. But for me, when I go to something like the red carpet premiere, it is fun for me, and that's what it is. It's an enjoyment of an entertainment. That's ultimately, in the end, what the sympathizer is. It's an extreme the TV series. It's an extremely expensive entertainment. And that has to be balanced against the fact that real world things are happening, like Israel's war on Gaza. And that puts everything in perspective. It doesn't mean that I can't celebrate the sympathizer, the TV series, and have a good time. But to also pretend that that's the only thing that's happening is also like a moral, would be a moral failure on my part, I think, given my concerns and what I write about. So it is, in fact, very difficult for me, because I have to fluctuate between enjoying and celebrating a work that is not only about me, but is also about the hundreds of other people, creative people who are involved in the show. I want their work to be recognized. I want their work to be celebrated. I want their work to be rewarded in the world. And yet at the same time, I'm also cognizant that there's all these other people I know whose lives have been drastically affected by Israel's war on Gaza. So I have to do both. And the fact that in my Instagram feed, you can see the contrast between a TV entertainment about a war in the past and real life images about a war in the present, that discombobulating reality and juxtaposition is in fact the world. So I'm actually okay with having that mix or mashup happening in such a dramatic way on my personal feed.
This mix and mashup, you do a lot of you put a lot of thought into your posts, and I'm always shying away from having to put my thoughts out there, and it's a tough thing for me, living in this world of media, and I want to grow into it, but I find that it's very difficult to manage time when you're both creating you're writing and you're creating that stuff, but then also doing the post itself. How do you kind of manage and balance all of this social media work with your teaching, with your writing?
I'm grateful to have a team of research assistants. So, in fact, I mean, everything, I think 95% of the content that's on my social media feed, I write it, Right. But I have a research assistant, Faith Nguyen, who does the graphic design and will, gussy things up for me. So that helps a bit. But the words, all the stuff that's about Gaza, for example, or all the stuff that's about the sympathizer, I wrote that one way or another. So that's the important part. But it helps, that to have people do things for me that I don't, it doesn't require my intellectual brain
Yeah.
power. Like posting for me on social media, posting the actual content that I write on social media, or look, for example, I have an article forthcoming about the National Book Awards from the 1950s. I wrote it, but I have another assistant, Kathleen Huang, from Colombia, of all places, who, I tasked with the research for that. Like I said, hey, we're going to talk about all the books that won the National Book Award in the 1950s. Give me an Excel sheet so I can look at all of the information. So she did that. So I think for me, I had to grow into this role as being a manager and a boss of different folk, the different young people who work with and for me. As long, but again, the issue is, does my intellectual and creative and personal vision steer the tasks that I assign to them? And then hopefully they learn something from the work that they do for me as well.
Well, it sounds like you have a young team of Vietnamese students or previous students of yours.
Oh yeah, it's really been great. There, at USC, you've been there. There's a lot of Vietnamese energy taking place. So it's really been cool. Like, one of my former students gave the baccalaureate speech a few years ago. He's Vietnamese American, then went off to teach in Vietnam on the Fulbright on the border of China. Another young woman, her family runs one of the big Vietnamese food enterprises out of Orange County. I mean, these kinds of folks, I mean, just really, really interesting young Vietnamese Americans. They're not all Vietnamese Americans, the ones who work for me, but the ones that are Vietnamese Americans, I just find it so cool that they're this new generation that, is aware of its history and all that, but they're also freed from that history, as we discussed earlier, but freed even more than you and I don't think they have that same, emotional connection to the past, because it was really their parents and grandparents who went through all of this.
Yeah.
And all these young people were born in the United States well after the war was over. So for them, it's more of an intellectual and somewhat emotional relationship to the past. And they're just going to carve out completely new directions for themselves in the next 20, 30, 40 years that I just can't even predict.
Speaking of young people and carving out new paths and things that you cannot predict, can you talk a little bit, and we'll finish up with Simone. We'll talk about the book and where we can find it, and what's the book about.
Sure. It's my second children's book. The first one was Chicken of the Sea, done with my son Ellison Nguyen and illustrated by T. Bui and her son Hien Bui Stafford. And that just came out of Ellison's head. And it was the idea about bored chickens who run off to become pirates. I never could have come up with that. And so I talk about the unexpected and just following the muse. And I mean, I've just tried to listen to my children, listen to my emotions that I've been excavating and dealing with, trying not to be the same person I was when I was 20 or 30 years old, and embracing ch new challenges. So that's where the becoming a children's book author has come from, is the willingness to play, to be exposed to new challenges. And in the case of Simone, the book, it's named after my daughter Simone, who's 4. It's not really about her, but the artist Minnie Phan came to me with an idea. She wanted to do a book about a young Vietnamese American girl confronting wildfires in California. And that's what she had. And so I took that and I expounded a whole story about this young girl who's probably 8 or 9 years old, and about how she is an artist and, displaced from her home by wildfires, she turns to her artwork to cope with being displaced into a high school gym, and it's trying to inspire other children to use art to distract themselves, but also to imagine a different and better future and world for themselves as well.
When does the book come out?
Yeah, you can probably order it now, but the official release date is May 7th. But the hard
Okay.
copies are definitely out there, because Minnie and I just did an event together at the LA Times Book Festival with the hard copies of the book. And go to my website, vietnamese.info/events, for a rundown of our public appearances for Simone. In fact, I'll be back from my travels on May 5th, and that weekend there will be a few events from Pasadena to Riverside to Long Beach, in LA, where Minnie and I will be together talking about the Simone, including the Viet Book Fest in Orange County.
Viet, thank you so much for coming on the show. I always enjoy having you in my life and seeing you in our community and having you on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Ken. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.